this show is not for the easily offended. So if you are easily offended, go listen to something else.
Hey, here we are again. It's Indie Comic Book Noise, episode 389. We're not counting the little bonus episode in there.
What do you mean?
Oh, that's nice.
We worked hard on that.
Yeah.
Well,
we were across that thing
half
actually
an hour of our time.
I was told not to count the bonus episode. It's our Halloween show. Our third year anniversary show. How about that? It's Steve Raker here from the Comic Book Bunker, along with Phil and Kevin, Whirlwind X, and Andrew, the LA Rabbit.
I gotta say, 3 years is pretty impressive, gentlemen.
That's too much, Kevin. Way too much, Kevin.
Our first episode was episode 330 in the very beginning of November 213 when we took over the reins of this here podcast. It was a coup. You can check in with Indie Comic Book Noise on Facebook, on Twitter, and IndieComicBookNoise.com for past episodes. They're all well tagged to see what we were talking about. And listen to us on our sister show, Marvel Noise, where we talk about all things Marvel and keep a regular schedule.
Well, more regular.
I'm nice and regular. I eat my fiber.
Someone's there.
I got a bad case of the squirts.
Boy, this episode's we're reaching for the stars for our third anniversary.
I went to another. I did another con.
You did?
I did.
What'd you do there?
I sold some video games, some comics, some toys, all sorts of stuff.
Whoa, toys? That doesn't sound good. No more toy shots?
I'm pretty sure he can get rid of a few.
Well, yeah. Yeah, there's only so many Hulks you can own, and then it's like, yeah, I got to get rid of some of these. Like, why do I need them?
So you can construct your Agents of Smash.
Apparently.
So this is our Halloween show, so let's talk about Halloween books.
Yeah, spooky shit.
What have you been reading?
I'll start off. I've picked up this new series by Aftershock, which you remember is that newish company that has been putting out some great titles. I forget the name of the one I was reading recently and I reviewed, but this one is called Aminosity, which is by Margaret Bennett and Raphael de la Tour.
You have the first issue of that?
Two issues so far.
Oh.
You got it?
No, I just remember it was on the radar of some people were flipping some of those.
Well, it has very, very nice covers, very catching covers. And basically it's a story about as if animals basically all of a sudden can talk and think with humans, like just all of a sudden it's almost like they wake up kind of thing. And pretty much every issue has made me teary-eyed, like one to multiple times, just because like the first issue, you have a splash page. And it has a whole bunch of animals in different situations. Like you see a woman with her dog and she's getting ready to put it to sleep. A cow getting ready to be tagged. Pandas locked up in a reserve. A hamster eating its babies. Things like that. Then you flip it and you just see like something go off in their eyes. Like all of a sudden they know what they're doing. And then it goes to the other page and like you see the gerbil eating the baby and like the other babies are going, she's evil, run, run. Or, like, the dog is like, don't cry, I understand, and I forgive you. Like, just, there's some really sad shit in here. Like, if you're a big animal lover or dog lover like I am. And,
like, does mostly, Mr. Ed tell Wilbur he's a shithead?
Well, there is one part where there's a
Wilbur!
A horse that ends up kicking the cop or whatever that used to ride him kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of animals are kind of angry how they've been treated, that kind of thing. And this is kind of based around a little girl and her dog kind of thing. And the dog is just trying to protect this world or this girl in this new world where the humans are trying to adjust and the animals. Like it's almost, it's basically the first issue is kind of it's on its way to becoming an apocalyptic type comic almost. And which you see by the end of the second one. And it's, you just, a lot of it's at the start is just like, the humans not being able to work together with the animals that do want to work with them and stuff, and kind of freaking out. Like, there's one part where the dad of the little girl just starts beating her dog with a rock. And you don't really know what happens, but it kind of skips ahead after that, and it's just the dog and the little girl on her own, and the world's a lot more messed up. But there's, like, cool imagery of, like, the third issue cover is her on a buffalo with, like, this, and the buffalo has, like, armor on and stuff, or, like, a koala with handguns. Like, there's just some really neat imagery in it. The art is, I wouldn't say it's the best, but I really enjoy it, and I think it works well for the comic. I'm not as picky as art as you guys might be, but overall, this, the girl that wrote it, I think she's done a lot of work for, like, Boom. She's done A-Force recently.
Yep.
I imagine you guys would know her from there, know her better than me. And, I really enjoyed her work. I thought she did a great job capturing emotion. And, like I say, if you're an animal lover, I don't know, it might hit you too much to read it, but at the same time, maybe you enjoy it more. Maybe that's why I enjoy it so much, just because it gets me on the emotional level, you know? But it's one I highly recommend. I've been happy with these Aftershock comics for the most part. Not all of them, but for the most part, they're pretty solid books. And they usually have pretty well-known people working on them, so it's not like just like very indie, but yeah, this is a company that I hope sticks around for a long time. And is it necessarily a horror book? Not really, but it's post-apocalyptic. There's a lot of gore in it. You know, people being torn apart by maybe a tiger or something. So it does fall in that category.
Somewhat lighter fare, I was recently finished reading the collection of Die Kitty Die, which is from Dan Parent and Fernando Ruiz. They're from Archie Comics.
Mm-hmm.
But Die Kitty Die is not from Archie Comics. Actually, it's now been released digitally through Comixology and in print from Chapter House Comics.
Yeah, which I found weird, because that's the Captain Canuck one, right?
Well, yeah, they're Canadian.
Okay. Yeah, Canadian publisher.
Well, I met Dan Parrott. I have a bunch of his stuff signed at Fan Expo.
Yeah, he's great. I can't get enough of Dan's art. I love his sense of color. Yeah. I love his girls. I got several pieces of original art of Dan's. He's awesome. Mm-hmm. And Die Kitty Die was a Kickstarter last December for the first four issues and the trade, which hit a stretch goal to become a oversized hardcover instead of just a regular trade paperback, which is great. And like I said, the first issue in print of the four issues that make up this collection are out now, both in print and digitally. The second Kickstarter for the next four issues, and it's also already hit its stretch goal to become a hardcover collection, so get it, and you can get the first hardcover as well. This second Kickstarter is currently underway, and there's all kinds of stretch goals for sketches and extra add-ons for sketch and art goodies and all kinds of stuff like that. The basic premise is that Kitty Ravencroft is a beautiful young witch, and she's the star of her own comic book, and the first part of each issue kind of have, like, flashback classic Kitty comics that they reference, you know, like, this is from Kitty and Pals from 1988 or something, or from 1960. And they have, like, the dot coloring on those issues so you can tell that they're vintage compared to the, you know, stuff that's happening in the current time. But she's a young witch, and she's like I said, she's the star of her own comic book, and we get to see these flashback sequences to her comic that are kind of like, they've got like a Patsy Walker kind of vibe, and then various Harvey comic books are sort of intertwined, like the Casper and Hot Stuff and Richie Rich. They've got their own versions of them, like Casper allegory is Dippy the Dead Kid, who's this creepy looking little dead kid ghost. Kitty's comic, though, I mean, this is the 90s and beyond, we're in the 2000s here, Kitty's comic isn't selling like it used to. You know, comics used to sell a million copies per issue, including Kitty's. So her publisher tries a stunt to raise sales. She's going to kill off Kitty, the real Kitty, to get her book to spike. And there's pinups galore, there's variant covers, there was even a Darwin Cook cover. Because there's this comic industry scenario, it allows for some real clever, like meta commentary on the comic book industry and artists and stuff, which is fun. And since the first Kickstarter was as wildly successful as it was, and all the extras were thrown in, I got a real nice head sketch of Dippy by Fernando and Kitty by Dan in my hardcover of the first edition, which is great. The current Kickstarter is Die Kitty Die Hollywood or Bust. And like I said, there's also great art rewards that you can get there too. And for the sequel, the thing is, like, Kitty's publisher has now sold the rights to make a movie, so they're going to make a Die Kitty Die movie, which will allow us to see Kitty and her gang tackle the movie entertainment world after seeing them in the comic book world. It's clever. It's got that Archie cartoony look to it, but it is certainly more risque material than Archie, although there's no nudity. It's all more flirtatious and fun. Great colors, fun idea and execution. Die Kitty Die. Definitely worth checking out. I'm dropping the mic. Boom.
I was waiting to see who would win in the standoff with Andrew.
You can go ahead, Kevin. I don't want to be greedy.
Okay. I got a real beat-up comic here. Someone even did some, looks like, math calculations on the back cover.
Yeah. Never seen that.
But I'll take us back to another Dr. Spectre story. You know, the alcohol files. Yeah. Gold Key. You know Western Publishing?
Oh, yeah. Wait, Gold Key was Western Publishing?
It says Gold Key and Design is a registered trademark at Western Publishing Incorporated in the USA and Canada. No creators listed, though, so I guess that was their thing, right? Wasn't important to them.
I think back then you just hit a button on a computer that said comics, and the comics got printed out.
I thought that's what they do nowadays. Anyways, this is the, you know, this dude, Dr. Spectre, who seems to have on, I don't really know what his powers are. Like, I read that other issue with that weird, the alligators and asteroid from outer space and whatever. He did... I wonder if there's an origin where they tell you exactly what his powers are, because it seems like he's a little Doctor Strange-ish in his powers, just like, oh, or Batman-ish in a way, because he's like, oh, good thing I have that, you know, backup personality in my head, so when that thing tried to kill me, I said that incantation, so my soul left my body and then returned 5 minutes later, so I escaped death. And I'm like, wow, that's an interesting power to have. But anyways, we're going to Egypt here, because they just uncovered a new tomb. And this mummy is supposed to have, like, this type of golden mask. They're like, oh, that's weird. That golden mask was supposed to, like, seal in this dude. So, of course, they're thinking, like, this mummy, like, the soul within the mummy has, like, escaped to someone else and is controlling someone else.
Just an update, he has no powers. He's just a skilled investigator of the occult, it says.
That's not true. He knows magic and all these moves.
Well, that's just because he does use, like, talisman or shit like that.
He just uses crazy stuff.
Yeah, because it said the only time he had powers was 11 through 13 because he turned to a werewolf for a while.
I would disagree with that.
Making it a Halloween
book. I would totally disagree with that.
Yeah, it's Wikipedia.
A mummy chokes him to death, and then the caption after that, he says, had I not put myself into a yogi trance as he choked me, I would have never escaped death.
That's not a superpower.
Yeah, normal people can do that kind of stuff. That's just like I can see occult people doing that. There's crazies in this world right now doing shit like that.
Yeah, that's like Batman stuff.
When this Egyptian mummy dude is switching bodies, of course he has a woman with him as an assistant, and of course the mummy is like, oh, so she's attracted to the other guy. So the mummy goes into Dr. Spectre, and of course asks the woman to marry him and all that stuff. But the guy Dr. Spector's in the mummy body, and he knows the magic and words to say so he can switch himself back into his own body.
But it's like Constantine, you know, like he doesn't have magic,
magic
powers. He's just learned things over the years. Kind of.
I don't know. I think he might even say the magic words. Oh, I learned the word. Like, I guess if he, but that's, I guess it's Batman level anyways. If you have like backup personalities and crazy stuff like
you
that,
read
like,
a book,
that's very
learn
spiritual.
A spell, that's not a magic power. That's not a power.
I guess he's the greatest of everything, though.
So,
well, what's his stock portfolio look like?
Western Publishing, they outsource their comics to be produced by Dell Comics, and in '62. Ended that arrangement and started making their own comics and called it Gold Key, which was the same as Whitman. Whitman was their version that was sold in the plastic bags in the department stores. And after Gold Key was like crumbled, they hung on as Whitman for a little while in the department stores because they were also distributing DC books that way until they faded away in the early 80s.
Yeah, I remember some of the Whitman DC.
So Dell and Gold Key and Whitman are kind of all the same thing. Kind of.
That would make sense. You also get some of the cool old ads in here. You know, your Cell Grit. Your Grit. Wow 88 mini posters for 65 cents. Kids Roach designs are now available as iron-on transfers.
Oh, yeah.
Your sea monkeys?
I love sea monkeys.
They do
so
much. I
just read a disturbing article about that dude. He's like a big white supremacist, according to this article by the LA Times. That ain't good.
The sea monkey guy?
Yeah. It's not good.
There was a singular sea monkey guy?
Yeah. He, you know, developed them so they could live in... sort of engineered the creature from what it was.
Well, I'm pretty sure it's dried up sperm, and then you throw it in the water, and then they just start swimming around.
No,
he's a little creature, and developed the nutrient bath that revives him and everything. But yeah, it turns out he is not a nice man.
But he made something so beautiful.
I mean, no offense to our white supremacist listeners. I don't want to, you know... I
would advise if we have the white supremacist listeners, don't listen to the
I don't think
you'll
mind losing
noise.
That.
I hate to pass the mic to Andrew, but it's your turn in the queue.
Andrew's going to like this ad, though. Like, it says, Disneykin play characters are here. Colorful, exciting, and they're fun.
I like
special
these.
Offer for limited time. You can get 4 all-time Disney favorites for only $1. There's a long list here,
all right.
But they have Snow White, Seven
right.
Dwarfs, Pinocchio, Jiminy Cricket, Bambi, Thumper, Peter Pan, Captain Hook, Minnie Mouse, Dumbo, and many, many more.
Do all the dwarves count as one choice? Or am I going to get an incomplete set of dwarves?
I'm not sure, because this picture is pretty faded. There, it says there's set A...
Huh?
And set B.
Huh?
How come they don't list the dwarf? Maybe you only get one dwarf. That'd be disappointing.
Doc.
And it is hilarious because it says Gandalf Products Company.
Andrew, what you got?
Well, when it was Halloween and horror comics... That instantly makes me think of anthology books, because it seems like horror is like
one
of the last places that's the thing. So I have Forbidden Panels presents Forbidden Tales Volume 1 from 2013. I got this at some sort of show because it's signed, or maybe it was a Kickstarter or something. But so this is the Forbidden Panel. They have a website, forbiddenpanel.com. And this is their, so they have their own, you know, they have this witch that She's, I guess, what is that guy? The Crypt Keeper? What, you know, the
Uncle Creepy.
All them guys that sort of run throughout the book and introduce the little tales and everything. So this is the Forbidden Tales Witch. And there's three stories. First one, John Narcomi, Jimmy Purcell, Daniel Whitfield. And they're all written and drawn by the same, by the named person.
This is an older book or a newer one?
2013. So is that older? I don't know.
No. That counts as more newer.
So the first one is Make Out Mayhem. And this one thing I love about this, these are all black and white, by the way. Well, the second one's got the gray, the second and third have gray tones, but the first one's black and white, which I like. Very kind of that very fine line. But what I like is on page two, there's like a gratuitous nude scene of the girl in the shower. So that's also very horror comic to me. Just like, yeah, you gotta have it. And it's like a teen romance type thing. And this girl's going on a date with a guy with one of them old-timey hot rods where they don't have a hood on the car. I don't know nothing about cars, but you've seen those ones, right, guys?
Sure, with a rumble chair in the back. Rumble seat.
Yeah, yeah. So he's like a greaser-looking guy, and he's taking the hot girl out on a date. And her ex-boyfriend, who looks kind of has like the crop-cut hair, maybe he looks like he's in the army or a football player or whatever, and saying how he's sorry and he's going to get her back and everything. And she's like, it's too late. So she goes out on the date with the greaser looking guy. And then suddenly this monster jumps on the roof of their car and rips her head off. Yeah. And it's her boyfriend. He's a werewolf. And so he threatens the new boyfriend, and the new boyfriend has a secret, and I'm not going to reveal what that secret is. And then it ends with a goofy pun joke.
No, I hate secrets.
Well, the boyfriend is, the greaser guy is a vampire. So he decapitates the werewolf and drinks his blood. And then he ends it with, because he wasn't that into the girl. He was just going to drink blood anyways.
Drink juice? I get it.
So, yeah. And then after that, there's a bunch of sketches and he talks about his design. So I'm like, that's cool. Not only to get the story, but you get his whole thing. Then the next one is called Bowel Movement.
Uh-oh. Let's see where this is going.
And it's about a handyman who goes to help out an older guy. And he's like, and he thinks the older guy's crazy because the older guy keeps talking about toilet monsters. Mm-hmm. Toilet monsters crawl up through the toilets and take over your body.
I had a fear for years in my life.
Wasn't that an X-Files episode?
And Ghoulies. I used to be scared of that movie Ghoulies because they came up through the toilet.
Yeah, that's what this guy's. And then the guy's like, oh, really? Well, I'll take a look. And he's rolling his eyes. But you see in a panel reveal that the old guy has some problem with his backside. And it turns out the toilet monsters are real. And they wanted him to take over the handyman so they could leave. You know, the old body was no good. And they wanted the new body. And then it also ends with a little stinger of a joke, because these all have to have one. And then again, it's followed by like three pages of sketches. Then the last one is the woods.
Nice art too.
The second one is the great. It's got that feature where the character designs are well, but the backgrounds are pretty sparse. Mm-hmm. Even though the panels are pretty, there's not a lot of panels on the page. And I want to say that's a feature I've noticed in a lot of web comics. I don't know if this is from a web comic. But that kind of feel where there's not much detail in the back, but it's not a bunch of little panels either,
mm-hmm.
which I always associate. It's not like that real fine work of the first one. The next one also has that looks like it could have come from webcomic. It's got a little bit more detail, but the I can't figure out if all the little feathering work is done on a computer or just all done by hand. But I like the last one, The Woods, has that. Where it's a little boy and his dog, and they end up in this haunted wood, and the dog like drags him in, and it's this tree with like teeth and a tongue, and the tree ate his dog, which is really sad. And so the boy goes to help the dog and go rescue him. So he climbs inside the tree.
Oh, whoa! Is this like a kite eating tree?
Well, it's a dog and boy eating tree, and then it's to be continued. This is the only one that's not a one. Oh. And it has a bunch of sketches in the back of it. And then there's a one page on the inside cover, or backside cover, The Mask of Devouring. But, I mean, at one page is really not. It's basically the setup. And that was Forbidden Tales, Volume 1, three different art styles. You know, violence, cheesy puns, gratuitous nudity. What more do you want in your horror book, for criminy's sake?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Like, when I went to their webpage, I didn't see this book advertised anymore. But then again, it's 3 years old.
So yeah, I don't usually know how you... If it's smaller, yeah, it'll go out of print. It sucks.
Because, yeah, I mean, now they have a bunch of other books on the website, but... You know, this is volume one. Maybe they did other volumes. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I just, you know me, I buy comics and read them. It's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
You probably want to see them at the con, and then maybe they'll have it there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it must, I just don't. I probably should have, if I had Steve's Genius Book Plates, I'd know what con this came from. But instead, it's just signed by them. But yeah, fun. Like I said, where else, other than like these kind of showcase ones where they're showcasing new talent, that's about the only of those in horror are the only places that anthologies still are around.
Yeah Well, that's Halloween's a great time because basically all Halloween specials are anthologies too, so it's a great time to get a horror anthology. I've been reading a lot of those lately too. So next on the plate I have, as you guys know, I happen to have an addiction to bad comics, and earlier in the year, I think it was this year, I talked about a new comic by Double Take, those 10 first issues, and I gave them really bad reviews because it said they pretty much suck balls. Well, all 10 trades came out at the same time, which is a horrible marketing move for a new company. Like, don't release all 10 issues and all 10 trades the same day. They should really spread them out, you know, if you want people to take a chance. But, yeah, so I got all 10 trades, of course, dummy.
So it wasn't a bad marketing move at all.
Well, this is the thing. This is how they suckered people, because their Kickstarter, like, basically because Night of the Living Dead is free domain, they're like, okay, we're going to do a new take on that. So that was their, like, selling point to get everyone to invest, right? And the funny thing is, too, a video game company owns this. So they were basically, they wanted to make their own comic line. So they contacted Bill Gimmis, you know, from Marvel. Yep. Do you remember him?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Kevin and I
talked about him.
Kevin and I discovered he came from Fleer, actually, before Marvel. That's how he got into Marvel.
I think he's kind of a swamp donkey. Because I read this interview by him where he said this was some of the best comics on the market. And these trades are a mess. Every issue is done by like six different artists, and the next issue will be six different artists. There's like four writers on each issue. The art is horrible. And the whole point of this is that they tie in together. And you know how they do that? They take six, seven issues from another issue and put those exact same pages right in, and they don't even fit in the scene. Every issue has this character saying a monologue about like a skiing trip they went on. In this... It's all the this is the only dialogue you'll read for three issues. And it's pointless. It has nothing to do with the story, and it's the worst story ever. And every different title does the same thing.
But I thought you bought some of this before, Phil.
Yeah, I know, but it's the Night of the Living Dead thing that I was like, okay, maybe I just didn't read enough.
I know, but you,
how was that,
you read...
at least?
Not good. There's no zombies. The people, this is zombies for them. Zombies are people that died, but they have no wounds, nothing like that. They look exactly normal. They talk. They have minds. They're the exact same people. That's a zombie to them. And they added this alien shit. Like, this has nothing to do with the movies at all. They added this alien stuff, these random scenes that just make no sense at all. And the stupid thing is, they have five new series coming out soon, and they're turning it to a superhero comic now, continuing the story.
So I assume, like, you've pre-ordered them.
Yeah.
No way. No way.
I hear they're bundling the first issue of them all.
There is no story.
They're going to drop 47 trades at once, Phil. You got to get them all.
I mean, I'm sure. I might. Who knows? Who knows? Oh, but the point is, these are the worst comics I've ever read in my life. These are not comics. They're not stories. If you haven't picked them up but you've been thinking of it, please don't. Anyone out there?
You should not have done a double take on double take.
That's the sad thing, isn't it? Yep. So, yeah, this is the worst purchase I've ever made in my life. Like, I have no problem throwing these away. I won't even recycle them. I'll throw them away. I don't want these to be turned into something good.
It's forever scarred the paper. It's better.
Oh, yeah.
They have to be burned.
Yeah, that Bill Jimmis, I don't know if you guys like him or not, but I hate him.
I don't know him.
What a swamp donkey.
Never heard that phrase before, swamp donkey.
I got a book that gets teased often as insignificant at times, but really has stood the test of time, and I find it enjoyable just about every time I delve into the world that's presented within, and that is Jim Bullent's Tarot, Witch of the Black Rose.
Ah, I knew it.
Oh, I've been thinking of picking that up always, but I never have. I know number 100 came out recently.
Bullent's indie imprint is Broadsword Comics. They are available on Comixology now, too, either by issue, or I think some of them are even available as part of their, like, Comixology Unlimited. And Broadsword has its own website and its own digital Unlimited service as well of reading all the issues. And Bullent writes and draws the book, and the colors are done by his wife, Holly Golightly. Tarot is the armored sword maiden of the goddess, and she's a witch. And while some sequences in the past issues have pretty much solidified this book's place as, like, cheesecake fare, thanks to the mythologies and, like, the old stories that Bullent mines, the adversaries that Tarot faces and the conflicts that arise, they're often really compelling and have a hint of, like, that old world mythos that magic offers. And yeah, Bullent draws babes better than almost anyone, even if Tarot is overly top-heavy. But darn it, this book has stood the test of time, and it just hit issue number 100. How about that?
That's quite an accomplishment for any book.
I read the last three issues here. Issue number 98 has Tarot encountering and wrapping up a loose end from all the way back in issue 13 of the series with Izzy, the stitched-up doll that is alive, and her teddy bear that's stitched up that is like this gargantuan, horrific thing, like a big grizzly bear thing. And meanwhile, the Jim Bullent, like, analogous character who is Tarot's love interest, I mean, hell, that's how I depict myself in the series, too, he's, like, fighting hard as a vigilante, the skeleton man, and he gets stabbed and shot for his efforts, but he gets to come home to Tarot and get all healed up and all that. They've been really focusing on the two of theirs' relationship because it's been building towards issues 99 and 100, which are the wedding issues. And in 99, Tarot travels to, like, Fairyland for this big bridal party, but she gets abducted after being attacked, and she gets replaced by a wooden doppelganger that's magically brought to life. So it's like, oh no, the skeleton man's gonna marry a tree. It all really done well. The production value's top-notch. I love Bullent's art. Every time I read these issues, especially if I read a chunk of them, I find that there's something that really catches my fancy, whether it's visually or the color palette or some story about leprechauns or some Celtic mythos or ancient European fairy story that was, you know, he's doing an adaptation of. It's all cool stuff, and by being around so long, it's become a hub for some witch culture to be supportive of, and I think more ideas flow to Bullent, and I think it just becomes this perpetuating machine, and it's a lot of fun. You should check out Tarot, Witch of the Black Rose.
Can you jump? Is it the type of thing where you can jump in anywhere you want, or does it really have a lot of history?
There's a lot of done-in-ones, and there's a lot of little arcs. I find that there's, like, two or three characters that you kind of got to figure out who they are and mm-hmm. two of them are just Taro and her boyfriend, basically, and the rest just falls into place because, again, it's the it becomes the situation. It becomes whatever myth Balent's doing his rendition on. You know, it's like an old one of those old Lee Kirby Tales of Asgard kind of thing, but with boobies. But it's cool stuff. I mean, it's a integral part of witchcraft is the whole sensual woman type aspect. So a lot of and orgasmic and enlightenment and all that stuff. And that, you know, it's not overly done, although there are scenes, occasional scenes where they might dwell on it a little too much. But again, it's surrounded by a lot of fun comicking. It really between the illustration and the production value and the storytelling, it's just good stuff.
It's been on my radar for years, but it's not one you commonly see in a comic store. And I don't know if he's put out trades or not.
Yeah, there are trades. They're way behind the singles, though. I think the trades are only probably up to maybe like in the 60s of the issues, even though that... and the trades are kind of expensive as well, I've discovered, although they have a lot of the variant covers and stuff in the back, so you get a nice package. But I think these unlimited opportunities via Broadsword Comics' own website and Comixology Unlimited are great. But again, because of the thing of him tying to different old stories and stuff, also you could just go and grab an old back issue on Comixology, the ones that are less expensive than the current stuff.
Well, it's digital.
And grab a Christmas issue. Grab a Halloween issue.
I was going to order from my store issue 100.
Because, there's all great myths and stuff that surround all of our holidays. And, way before it was in style in comics, Taro was doing Krampus stories, and Valentine's Day stories with a twist that get into, crazy stuff about Valentine's and et cetera. St. Patrick's as well and Halloween. It's fun stuff. Step up to the plate, Kevin. Step
I have
up
something.
To the plate.
Yeah, you gotta learn when these transitions are, Kevin.
Batter up.
I have a sci-fi story.
Spooky one.
Do they all die?
I'm not sure. I thought it was kind of spooky.
Oh, it's a 41 volume manga.
No, it's from Study Group Comics.
Oh, cool.
It's Vile One, The Coward's Hole. By Tyler Laundry. The cover is purple and like fluorescent green. And that's basically like your only colors. Inside it's all just like the green. And it's kind of pulpy, like the paper. It reminds me of like construction paper or something. And it's all black. I don't know, it's just
it makes
it
the book
feels
too
weird. Slightly oversized too. But it's basically this dude. He was fighting some kind of war, and then towards the end, like the enemies shot him, and he didn't get away in time, and he like falls through like a manufactured black hole. So he eventually lands on this planet, and he's just like roaming around. I kind of think of like the Twilight Zone. Like some of the best episodes are just like people wandering around are lost somewhere and they're just like slowly going mad type of thing. And they just start talking. They could be talking to people or not talking to people. You don't really know.
Or even John Carter, that wandering off the battle, going from battlefield to interdimensional, another landscape place.
It's just kind of crazy. Like he crash lands and it seems like he's just wandering around for days doing stuff, and then he starts, I guess it's sort of having like an existential crisis if he's important enough to be rescued, and he starts examining his life type of thing, and he's just like, well, they're going to come and rescue me, right? I'm important, because apparently he came up with all this stuff, but you're not exactly sure, and then he starts talking to these skeleton dudes that might be like astronaut companions from like another ship, or not.
I guess they didn't get rescued.
And also, it gets kind of creepy because, of course, they have like some zoom ins on like eyeballs and stuff. So I started thinking of like, when you get to those monolith scenes in 2001: Space Odyssey with the eerie, creepy type of music of thing. That's what I imagine while I'm reading this. And I'm just like, there's something just unsettling about the whole thing. And of course, all the like fluorescent green stuff is just weird. It works well with this story, though. I don't know if they're gonna like if there's gonna be another one, or it'll be just the like a totally different story. But I would totally be in for more.
Huh. Interesting.
But a lot really shadowy too. I just thought it was really cool. One of the things I picked up at TCAF, so I'm like, yes, more study group goodness.
Yeah, that one sounds neat.
All right, who likes real-world factual stuff in their creepy comics?
Uh-oh.
Me.
I think I told you guys, I kind of... I'm not really that into, like, Golden Age, and I do... And Silver Age, I like some stuff and don't. So there's always been one guy, like one of the great masters, who I recognize the talent, but he never hooked me, and that's Will Eisner.
Mm.
So I have the final thing, at least it says it's the final thing that he worked on.
Oh.
The plot, the secret story of the protocols of the Elders of Zion. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with the protocols of the Elders of Zion, but it's that racist fake tract that was supposedly written by these Jewish leaders about how they were going to take over the world.
I never heard of that.
It's a big conspiracy thing, and it keeps surfacing every few years, and I was familiar with it, but what I didn't know was sort of where it came from. And so he goes and tracks down where they think the original one came from, and it turns out that it looks like it was actually the original tract was written about the King of France prior to that in the late 1800s. And then what they needed was, in Russia, they wanted some anti-Jewish propaganda, so they rewrote this book that he had written against the King of France, and then just rewrote it to, you know, pretend it was the Jews instead of this diatribe against the King of France. And I thought that was like a really clever, like, to go back and track down the history of this whole thing is very interesting. But it, the original book was The Dialogue in Hell between Machiavelli and Montesquieu. And so then some advisors to the Tsar in Russia, right at the turn of the 1900s, need something to push the Tsar back to be more conservative and not do any kind of reforms. So they get a propagandist to rewrite that book to make it feel that like it's from the secret Jewish council. And in the graphic novel, they do a good job of comparing sections of the protocols and this dialogue. So you can see, yeah, I mean, clearly they lifted it from that. And the other part I thought that was interesting is not only does it track down how they show in the and various stories have been showing it's complete nonsense, but it keeps resurfacing. Obviously, you can imagine this was popular with the German National Socialist Workers Party, the Nazis. So Hitler cites it in his Mein Kampf and everything. But again, it's already been disproven. You know, there are articles in the English newspaper. And in 1964, the U.S. Senate has to issue a report saying it's false. Like, every time someone shows it's false, he puts a funny dialogue about how, like, oh, that'll be the last we ever hear of it. And then he just keeps going through about how in, like, 1987, a Japanese language version happened. In 1998, Hamas published it. And then 1992, a Mexican edition was listed in a few Catholic schools as required reading. So even though it keeps getting discredited and everything, these kind of conspiracy things won't go away. And it was just one of those kind of fascinating yet horrifying stories of how people, you know what I mean? They just want to believe the worst. So there's this clearly fake. And also, who would write out, like, the some evil master plan and have it just be in a book of, like, here's how we're going to take over the... It just, it doesn't even make any sense from its outside. But you guys know Will Eisner, right? It's like that ink wash kind of classic. So it looks great. It's a super interesting, like I said, I'd heard of this, but it's interesting to find out where it came from, kind of the history behind it, and just it won't go away. And his point in doing this book was to kind of give a populist account, because he said lots of scholars write about it, but this is something for, regular dummies like me, I'm not going to read some monograph in some scholarly publication about it, but I'll definitely read a comic book about it. So, especially a Will Eisner comic book, because the guy is, I mean, I can see the skill and everything. It's just I read The Spirit and Contract with God and stuff, and for just whatever reason, it never resonated. But I think that, you know, if you get a chance to read The Plot, The Secret Story of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, it came out in like 2005, I think. So I think he had just passed away, or right before or after. Anyway, this is the last thing that I'm aware of that he worked on. But yeah, it was really good. But it's just one of those kind of sad books about people that make me, make Andy sad.
Let's go one more round. Phil.
Okay. And then I have a surprise question.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
I do.
Well, oh. I'll just go very quickly with this. I picked up a few Halloween specials from this year. Usually any Halloween special I'll pick up. So I got three here. I got the Grimm Fairy Tales Halloween special, which is basically Robin Hood, Van Helsing, Avril Williams, who I have no clue. I think she's a witch. And Brittany Waters, who is Red Riding Hood. They all tell their own little tale. And pretty much all the tales just kind of go with who they are as a person. The only really original one was the Robin Hood one. And it doesn't star them or anything. It's just them telling a spooky story. Like, one's about a werewolf. One's about, like ghosts and some people trying to get rid of them. And then the ghosts end up... and it's about, like, a real place in New York, I think, or whatever, where the steps are still there. Like, they kind of spin it as a ghost story. Then I picked up the Puppet Master one. Puppet Master ones are always fun for me. It's not an anthology, but it's just a tale. No dialogue. You just see this monster kind of go into the old hotel. This takes place after the second movie, I think. And all of a sudden the puppets, you know, they start defending their home and killing it and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then you find out it's just a kid in a costume that was just going to spook his friend. And
so wait, the kid is dressed like a little puppet? I
thought no, the like a monster. No, more like a kind of like a creature from the Black Lagoon type monster.
Oh, so the puppets kill the kid?
Yeah, thinking it's a monster invading home that's going to hurt their little girl they're protecting.
I'm all down with the puppets. They seem pretty cool.
So at the end of the story, the only part with dialogue is this kind of flashback where you see the kid talking with his friends, how they're going to go play a joke on their friend. And then you see the other kids catching the puppets with the dead body. Then it flashes to the girl talking to the puppets, and you see them kind of having a weird look on their face, and then it goes to the to where the kids were originally talking in this cave, and they're all dead. So the puppets kind of, to cover their tracks, they killed them all. And the puppets aren't really evil. It's just a lot of the time they were controlled by evil people.
I'm team puppet, Phil, anyways.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm glad they killed all them little kids.
And yeah, it was a hit for me. Oh, and another thing about the Grimm Fairy Tales one, the art was really good. That was one thing I liked about it a lot, which is...
Was it different artists for each story?
Yeah, each short. Yeah, it was really good. And then the last one I got was a Zombie Trap Halloween special, which is a huge, thick issue, which is how I wish other comics kind of took it from this. But overall, it was kind of a slump. But I figured it wasn't going to be that good. Like, the first story is just Zombie Tramp and the voodoo girl she hangs around with, kind of taking out some frat boys and murdering them. Another one's a dumb trick-or-treat story where Zombie Tramp is just walking around because she can, and she ends up killing somebody. No point to it, really. And then it has the origin of the voodoo girl, which I was really excited for, because in the comic she's pretty badass. And she's the one that made Zombie Tramp. And it kind of had a strong start, like, because really strong start, but then her whole origin ended up being just kind of, it just didn't excite me at all. It was just basically she's just this preppy kind of high school student that kind of gets picked on a bit, and she just decides to learn voodoo, and there you go. All of a sudden, she's a master of voodoo. It makes no sense. I expected, like, a much more traditional voodoo type kind of origin or whatever. And then the last one is Vamplade, which is a comic I've wanted to talk about here for a long time. It's one of my favorite ones by Action Lab. And But this little story, it has nothing to do with really Halloween or anything. It's just kind of introducing you to her comic. It's good. But like I say, I love the comic. It's more worth picking that up. So this was kind of a thumbs down for me, though, this one. But the other two were good enough to pick up.
I also have a bit of a Halloween tradition to read a certain comic, although it used to pay off a lot more than it has in recent years, and that is from Bongo Comics, The Simpsons Treehouse of Terror.
Yep, I pick that up every year.
This issue, this year, it is issue number 22,
mm-hmm.
with a cover by Jason Ho that reflects the first story, which is a 13-pager with art by Rex Lindsay and inks by Pat Owsley, and that is a take on Ghostbusters called Ghost Bashers. There's, like, the nuclear plants being haunted by ghosts of ex-employees, including Smithers' father, which was funny. And when they get together and form their Ghost Bashers, why it's Ghost Bashers is that instead of it being, like, projectile weapons that shoot the streams, they're like batons, so they have to physically, like, beat down the ghosts. And you get to see, like, everybody who's died on The Simpsons over the years, which is funny, even, like, the saxophone player and all these old characters.
Grimy?
Right, exactly. And it's funny when they're doing the sequence of their take on the theme song, you know, when you see a ghost, better beat it down. Who you gonna get? Ghost Bashers! The panel that they show is the trio of them. It's Carl and Professor Frink and Homer beating the crap out of the Maud Flanders ghost in the Flanders living room, and like Ned and the kids are watching horrified, and Homer's like turning, looking over at the kids saying, yeah, maybe you kids better go in the other room, as they see their ghost mommy being beaten to re-death. And then they even do a take where the female Ghostbusters show up, Marge and a few of her posse, and they're like, the female ghost bashers are here to help, and they're like, nah, we don't need any help. And they're like, but we're all women. And they're like, nah, it's kind of redundant and kind of a dumb idea. And then they just kind of walk off. Kind of funny take on the new Ghostbusters franchise move. The second
I thought
story,
it was going to be the people that didn't like the female Ghostbusters are the ghost bashers. They're bashing the movie online. That's I don't know.
The second 13-pager is The X-Files, a take off, obviously, on The X-Files. Tone Rodriguez and Andrew Peepoy provide the art, and it's Lisa and Nelson joining forces to determine a mystery around school of different food items that have come to life and turned into, like, Kirby monsters that are eating people.
Oh, yeah, I think Salermo told me about this one because he's up on all things X-Files.
There's Phil Ortiz and Mike Rote. Oh, actually, you know what? In The X-Files, there's a really funny line of the principal, they want to call Principal Skinner, and instead they call his whatchamacallit, the FBI. He's like, let me check in with my half brother, Assistant Director Skinner of the FBI. So it like ties into the real X Files when he calls Skinner. I thought that was funny, and it ends with the two aliens that appear in every Halloween episode.
Oh yeah,
but it makes sense to have them appear in the X Files takeoff. The last two stories are quickies. One is Retirement Castle of the Vampires with Phil Ortiz and Mike Rote, and Bart and Lisa versus the Red Menace, drawn by Jacob Chabot, where they do a takeoff of the Looney Tunes episode with the big red-haired monster.
Okay.
You know, where they with the wearing the sneakers, where they have to like comb its hair and do all the things, just like in that episode. So it was clever, but it's lost the charm of, you know, what the old hook of this issue was year in and year out, was that they would get a whole bunch of different
indie
horror artists or indie artists, or, you know, they'd have Len Wein and Bernie Wrightson do a takeoff on the Swamp Thing, or, you know, all these different things that was made it more enjoyable. But I guess after all these years, they've kind of run the gambit and they're doing it a little cheaper, but it was still fun.
I hate The Simpsons, but I always pick that up because I do enjoy that. But like, you're right though, it's not, it's a little different than it used to be.
Kevin, your last ups.
I don't have anything because I was too busy buying and selling comics.
Andrew, you're last up. Bring us home with something.
Sure. I'm just going to go quick on a couple things. One is, one to let you guys know over my break, I read the first volume of Mind Management, one of Kevin's favorite books.
Yeah.
Oh! It's a good one.
I got the hardcover out of the library.
Big hardcovers, eh?
Oh, yeah.
They really take up a lot of shelf space.
Mine has the customized dust jacket.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. My only slight issue was I thought I would... The problem with some of these is kind of the wrap-up isn't as... I like more of the mystery. Like, I don't want to get a lot of answers. So I'm slightly worried the more I find out, the less I like.
Yeah, it ruins things sometimes.
Yeah, so I want them to keep it super vague and crazy. But I enjoyed... There's a lot there. It's fun to read the little marginalia notes about the Mind Management Manual.
Mm-hmm.
And total big thumbs up. You guys are right. It was fun. Like I said, just... I thought it was funny that Lindelof does the intro, and he's been criticized for not ending his thing well.
Isn't it printed on that cardboard type paper like Kevin was talking about too?
It's very stiff, very toothy.
Yeah.
Which is good because he's got that that style that seems to suit toothy. You know, where the colors kind of bleed all around everything, which is a way to make it look. But yeah, I have fun. I just, like I said, I don't want too many answers. That would ruin it. And I've also been, I don't know if you guys remember, one of the Didco things I backed, they sent me a whole bunch of stuff, was one of the random crap. And so I'm reading the Dick Ayers story, his illustrated autobiography, volume one. He wrote multiple volumes.
Wow.
So,
that's not the volume I would want to read, actually, of the Dick Ayers story. Probably somewhere around volume 5 is probably the era I want it.
So this is 24 to 51, and...
1924 to 1951?
Yeah. And wow. He really needed an ed. Like, it's fun, but it's super exposition. Like, he just jams it in the word balloons. Like the opening is like the dad and mom driving. Gladys, why do you want our baby born in Ossing, New York hospital when we live in Orange, New Jersey, and your mom's in White Plains, New York?
It's like one of those books you get for somebody for their like birthday who's a kid, and it has like, if you provide this information, we'll insert it into the story. And then
let's name the boy after a forefather, Theophact Bach's brother, Richard Bach, who married Benjamin Franklin's daughter, Sarah. That'll be, like, you know, just a lot of words. But it's still fun. Like, I like, you know, he talks about going in the army during the war and all his adventures. And the one fact I didn't know about Dick Ayers is he's colorblind.
Oh, is that why he created the white first Ghost Rider?
Which has given him a lot of great, you know, like in art school, it gave him a lot of trouble, and in the army he did a strip, but at times it got him in he used to like label his paints and everything so he'd know which ones they were. And otherwise he wouldn't mess it up. But yeah, that was kind of fat. But the book's in black and white, so no problems there. But and I like his art, and it's interesting. I mean, I goof on like the style is just jammed too much with exposition, but I'd say he had a full interest in life. I like it.
Is it jammed like a Golden Age comic?
It's suit well, not I would say like more mid range, like averaging 6 to 7 panels per page, but just dialogue and out the wazoo. But like the old Silver Age and Golden Age. Not a lot of splash pages in this one, kids. In fact, I don't know that there's any splash pages. So, but I also like how, for his art school stuff, again, some gratuitous nudity slipped in with the models.
I met Dick Ayers just a couple of years ago, right before he died, when he came up to right here in Albany, New York, at one of the small little Albany con shows. Pretty cool. He signed a Ghost Rider, Knight Rider now they call him, Bookmark.
Yeah, he, like I said, it's lots of fun. Like, it's a cool, like, I hope a lot of creators make their autobiographies in comic books. Like, that's a fun way to think about having, telling your, you know, kind of like the Stan Lee, Colleen Doran thing.
Right.
Like, that's how you tell your story. Like, tell it through comics. But I just think maybe a little bit of editing. But, who am I to have fun on it? It's a good, it's a laugh, you know? Everybody should enjoy it.
Yeah. I would recommend Fortune and Glory.
Yes. That's fun.
Yeah.
From Bendis. Yeah, Kevin, remember that time that Andrew did the Stan Lee story as his indie comic?
that wasn't from Marvel or DC, too.
Who's going to be doing the Marvel Noise story?
I hope no one for a long time. Because well, that ride and this ride ain't over, folks. All right, let's make this an episode.
Nope. Not to my surprise question. I don't think so.
I tried to get there. I tried to spare you guys.
It's very easy and quick. You don't have to talk about anything. I just want everyone to recommend one horror movie they like and one horror comic that you think people should pick up.
Ooh.
Oh, boy, what counts as a horror movie?
I can go first just while you guys think a bit.
Sure.
So for the horror movie, I recommend the Feast Trilogy, which is like horror comedies with a lot of gore and stuff, but
really?
Just really wacky, funny movies. And for the comic, I recommend by Keith Griffin and Tokyo Pop, I Love Halloween. It's three volumes. I've only read the first volume so far, but ordered the rest of just these trick-or-treaters on misadventures. Very funny and cute stories.
Those are good ones. I just, the night before last, watched for the first time in decades a new digital restoration on Blu-ray of American Werewolf in London.
Oh, nice.
Such a classic movie.
Uh-huh. Holds up, I think.
Yeah, it does. The nurse, Jenny Ogerter, is pretty now as she was then, at least in this movie. And, you know, the dialogue is snappy and it's funny and it really stood out to me as it's one of those first movies that went out of its way to take a whole bunch of pop songs and put them together as their soundtrack. But it worked because everything had like a moon, you know, theme to it. That was a lot of fun. My wife is like, it ends there when it ends. Like, it just ends there.
Yeah.
So that was good and nice and gory. And I was a big fan of Rick Baker and Tom Savini, the makeup artists. Du jour of that time. Savini, who worked under Baker, went on to do all the slasher movies like Friday the 13th and Halloween and all that stuff. And I had
Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah, right. And I had his book that he put out of like how he did his effects that came out in the early 80s that was called Grand Illusions. And I thought I wanted to be like a special effects Hollywood person for a while there.
Yeah. Me too. I had that dream once.
Very cool. So for me, that would be the movie. For a book, I'm going to straddle the line a little bit, and I just reread the wonderful Stephen King written text. It's under 100 pages, it's got to be, because there's a lot of Bernie Wrights and illustrations throughout. The Cycle of the Werewolf, it came out in the early 80s and in a soft cover with a bunch of great spot illustrations by Wrightson, who wanted to do a calendar, figuring that a calendar would be perfect for a werewolf because of the lunar aspect of the werewolf's existence, right? So he went to Stephen King and said, hey, would you write like a little blurb for each one of these images and it'll be a cool calendar? And King said that would be a really cool thing to do. But Stephen King's publisher was like, nobody else is putting out a calendar that you're writing anything on except us, and we're not. So they turned it into a short book, and a few years later it was made into a movie called Silver Bullet, I want to say.
Oh, okay. So I do know that one.
But the story is great, and the illustrations by Wrightson are fantastic, and there's currently a Bernie Wrightson Kickstarter going on where they're doing beautiful, greasy, high-quality archival ink and paper restorations of those old images and putting them in a big portfolio that should be really hot. I can't wait to see what it looks like. But Cycle of the Werewolf, and if it needs to be something sequential, go to one of Wrightson's other works that he did with Stephen King, and that's the original Creepshow adaptation, a nice oversized album where Bernie did all of the anthology stories that were featured in the first Creepshow movie.
Was that his art in the Creepshow movie?
Yeah.
Okay, I never knew.
And Jack Kamen on the cover. But yeah, and his Bernie's designs and stuff, and Bernie designed a bunch of different, you know, some different creatures and things for movies, and he's a master in many, many ways. Yep. Love that man.
All right, guys, you two are up.
I can't even remember the last horror movie I saw.
Yeah, I know you're not too big into horror, but you must have watched like maybe a kind of horror sci-fi or something, maybe.
The Shining. Like that's the only thing that comes to my mind.
That counts.
It's got Scatman Carruthers. Gotta love that.
Hong Kong Phooey.
No, as for something to read, try to find the manga Dragonhead. A train full of school kids goes into a tunnel, derails when something traumatic happens to the world. And they take a few volumes trying to get out of the train tunnel and see what's happened. And a lot of traumatic post-apocalyptic stuff.
The movie's worth watching, too.
Like, Kevin, I stopped watching horror movies about 20 years ago, but in my younger days, I always liked Bloodsucking Freaks, which was a really weird movie that bounced around from different distributors that seems vaguely exploitative of various ways, but it's this weird guy and he keeps a cage full. He guards his money by having this cage full of naked cannibalistic women. So if anyone tries to go in there, they get ripped
apart.
That's
a full moon. That's a full moon movie, eh?
So, yeah, it's a weird movie, but like I said, I haven't watched any horror. Kind of aged out of it or whatever at some point. But as far as comic books, I hate to do this, but I'm going to go back to one I recommended years ago here. Well, I didn't recommend, but we reviewed it, and that is from Dark Horse Comics. They did the Creepy Presents the Steve Ditko collection, which was where they took the stuff that Steve did and put it together in a very nice hardcover that's nice and big and sweet. Yeah.
And Creepy
and
also
great.
Did a hardcover like that of Corbin's material from Creepy and Wrightson's material from Creepy. I mean, there used to be special issues of Creepy that were like an all Wrightson issue that would reprint his stuff, but to have it all on a hardcover like that and Corbin and Ditko, awesome. Great
idea.
I want
to pick up all the trades of that stuff, but it's so expensive.
Well,
that's what's nice about these artists' spotlights.
They used to be cheap, you know, speaking in a Canadian sense. And also you could find them at Phil, I think at Fan Expo one year, the Silver Snail was blowing them out for like $15, $20 a hardcover.
Yeah, I would have grabbed them all.
Because what I like is I'm not like that stuff. It's okay, but I'm more targeted to the creator. So it's nice because I like Steve Ditko's obviously at the top, but I like Bernie Wrightson and a few of those others. So I don't need all the issues. I just like seeing the ones of the guys I like.
And Ditko,
yeah, and then they did one based on like a character too. What was it, like Hunter or something like that?
Oh yeah. The thing I like about Ditko one too is those Warren magazines were where he did some of those like tight ink wash stuff. That, I mean, it's like the only time you got to see that from Ditko. Really great stuff.
Yeah, I remember trying to bid on a page of that, but it went past my range of what I pay for pages, even for Steve Ditko, so I lost out.
We'll be right back. Radio Zeiger.